This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Reporters covering the war in the Gulf are operating under military restrictions. Their contact with coalition forces in the field is limited to supervised pools, and pool reporters must submit their work to military censors. These controversial Pentagon rules are the subject of a Senate committee hearing today. Some reporters in the Gulf are choosing to violate the rules, go off on their own, and bypass the censors. One of those reporters is Robert Fisk. Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent, and formerly wrote for The Times. He's covered wars in Lebanon, Iran, and Ireland. For the past 14 years, he's been based in Beirut. He joined us a few months ago to discuss his book Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. We wanted to find out why Fisk won't join a pool and play by the military's rules, so we called him in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Way back in August, when President Bush took the decision to send troops to Saudi Arabia, I suspected that there would be considerable restrictions placed on the press if, in fact, this turned into a war. And at the time, in fact, I spoke to my editors in London and told them that there probably would be some kind of pool system set up, as the Americans have done before, and as, of course, the British did in the Falklands, but that I didn't want to be part of it because I felt that it would inhibit reporting, that my job as a Middle East correspondent would be made much more difficult because, of course, I have to analyze events as well as report them, and also because I felt that the old-fashioned method of reporting wars, of going out on your own and being an eyewitness, was in the end the most truthful way of doing the job.
Are the rules for British reporters the same as the rules for American reporters?
They're very similar. As with the Americans, the British who came here, not on the pools, but all reporters who come here, were asked at the beginning of this crisis to sign a security agreement that we would not give away the locations of military units or future operational plans of military units. I indeed signed this along with all my colleagues. It was an agreement virtually identical to that which reporters accepted in Vietnam. And indeed, it's a set of rules which I have always imposed on myself in the Middle East, whichever country I'm reporting from. I think it would be quite wrong if we endangered the lives of those to whom we spoke on any side in the Middle East. So, like my colleagues, I signed this. It was my suspicion, hitherto and afterwards borne out, that the pools would not only be kept a long way from particular events, but could be organized and would find themselves, by a process of constant presence with the military, that the journalists who would be with the military would find that they became almost, if you like, part of the Army, part of the Air Force, part of the Navy. It's natural, I think, that if a person is pushed into a situation of danger, one comes to seek comfort from those around oneself. One comes to seek safety, of course, advice from them. And you become, you feel yourself part of the group you're with. And it seemed to me that while there may well be a case for reporters doing this, it would be quite wrong to allow a pool system to be the exclusive way of reporting a war.
As a British reporter, are you expected to submit your reports to the military before publishing it?
No, the only submission of reports is done by those on pools. When I go out in the desert on my own, or when, for example, I went to the Battle of Hafshi, I wrote my report and I sent it to London as I would in any other Middle East war, and it was not censored or scrutinized before being published.
How do you get around the military censors? And how are you operating on your own? I mean, I thought that the military would try to prevent any independent reporter from operating outside of the pools.
Well, I think you have to understand that Saudi Arabia is a very big place and that deserts are huge. You have to understand there's not a big room full of censors here. What happens is that there are a large number of journalists scattered around Saudi Arabia, some in the desert areas, in towns, some in Dhahran, which is where the major U.S. air base is, some in Riyadh, and one or two down in Jeddah. It's impossible to expect all these people, or rather to keep an eye on all these different people. Now, it was always understood, you see, that the military would impose a form of censorship on reporters in pools. The military had decided to use the pool system to throttle information by telling other journalists who were not on the pools that they would basically have to stay in their hotels or in the towns in which they'd found their hotels, and their job would be expected to be to recycle the pool material over to their newspapers. They never expected that reporters who were not in the pools would try to do their own job correctly, as reporters always have. So no system of censors was ever set up for the reporters operating on their own.
Has the British military complained to your paper, The Independent?
Not to my knowledge, no.
What kind of stories have you been getting that you don't think you'd be able to get if you were part of a pool?
Well, for example, about 6 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, I was out in the desert and found a number of very serious problems afflicting the Allied armies. One was that many convoys were getting lost. In one occasion, I discovered that an Allied convoy had traveled 220 miles in the wrong direction and had actually got within 200 yards of an Iraqi artillery battery right on the Kuwaiti border before it discovered its mistake. And the reason these mistakes were being made is that hardly any of the convoy commanders had been issued with maps. On another occasion, I found the medical authorities fearing that the commanders did not realize the scale of bloodshed that might occur in a land offensive. I discovered that they were actually building temporary mass graves beside their hospital, field hospitals, to accommodate those patients who died in their care, because they feared that the administrative arrangements for taking the remains of dead soldiers to the rear were not sufficient to cope with the number of casualties in the war. This is a typical example of a story which I obtained by not being on a pool, and which no pool reporter, in fact, would be given access to.
When you were exploring the town of Kafji after the coalition forces had reported victory, a network television reporter from a pool shouted obscenities at you and basically told on you, tried to turn you in to the military running the pool reports. Can you describe what happened?
Yes, I was just outside the town of Kafji at this point, and I was, in fact, in the company of U.S. troops to whom I was talking and to whom I'd identified myself as a journalist, when a pool television reporter, as you accurately say, came up to me and began to curse me and immediately brought up a public affairs officer from the American Marines who told me I wasn't supposed to be there. The American television pool reporter then told me I should go back to Dahran, that I was ruining it for him and his colleagues, even though he and his colleagues, in fact, had been kept out of the battle 20 miles away and had reported originally that the battle was over when I'd already discovered it was not. I thought it was a sad and, I think, for the pool concerned, a humiliating episode, because it suggested that the reporter concerned felt his priorities were such that he had placed a greater, for him, the privilege of being in the pool was more important than the ability of another journalist, in this case myself, to do my job. I thought that was a very sad reflection on the reporter and on the pool system. Although, as I say, I think that becoming a member of the pool, living with a military unit, does alter and fragment a journalist's sense of perspective, and I think it does so for the worse.
Has anything else like that happened to you?
Not so far, although some of my colleagues have run into faintly similar circumstances and found themselves told and ordered to go away by military officers in charge of pools. I think the real problem is that, you see, originally the system of the pool was quite a sensible one. The military decided that it was impossible to take, for example, 800 journalists onto a warship. You would obviously have to take a few and allow the other journalists to use the material which those reporters on the ship sent them. And the same would apply to a missile battery or a tank unit. But what the military have done in Saudi Arabia is they've manipulated this system. And instead of saying, OK, we'll take a few journalists with military units, the rest of you can do their job, they've said, we'll take a few journalists to military units, and the rest of you are not allowed to go anywhere. Thus, in fact, trying, and at the moment, hopefully, still failing, to control all information which the press can gather.
My guest is Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. He's speaking to us from Saudi Arabia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Fisk is my guest, a journalist who is not cooperating with the military press restrictions in the Gulf. Have you been reading the pool reports in American and British newspapers?
I've been reading the actual original pool reports until I found that they frankly, reflected the reality so little of what I see in the desert that I really stopped reading them. Some of them were couched in cliches and had so obviously were so obviously reading like military handouts that they seemed to me to be virtually useless, although I should add that that does not apply in all cases. Some reporters have kept their distance from the military by being within the pools and have managed to get over the fact that war is not about soldiers claiming that they're itching for action, but that it's about fear and boredom and homesickness as well. And to this degree, I think some of the reporters in the pools have done their job, but that unfortunately does not apply to all of them.
There's, I think, around 1,000 reporters in Saudi Arabia now, is that right?
I think it's about 1,300, although the figure varies between that and 800. In fact, the numbers of reporters here, this is a statistic that varies almost as much as the number of Iraqi tanks each day that we are told have been destroyed.
Do you think the presence of so many reporters could be very disruptive to the coalition forces if each of those 1,300-some-odd reporters were off roaming on their own?
No, because most of them are not. Many of the people you're calling reporters are, in fact, engineering staffs for American television networks, field producers who would never have any business leaving the area of the cities in which they're based. You're only talking, in fact, of a few hundred reporters, and many of them don't wish to go into the desert or into the front lines. Given the few who are, in fact, doing so, I shouldn't think they number more than about 80 to 100, and there's certainly no danger to the coalition forces in an area of so many tens of thousands of square miles having 100 or so reporters around.
Can you give us a sense of how you spend the typical day and how you decide where to go, what story to cover?
Well, sometimes, of course, I'm not out in the desert, but I normally try to travel with one or two colleagues who share my views on the way the war should be covered, and we normally take particular routes, which usually include Allied supply routes, where we know we can talk to soldiers and where we know where units are, and we can go to desert villages where we know some of the soldiers now and can talk to them, and in some cases can approach very close to the Kuwaiti border, so close that we can see the fires of the B-52 bombings on the Iraqis and can actually pick up it, for example, so close we can pick up the leaflets which the Allied aircraft drop, ordering or suggesting or trying to persuade the Iraqi soldiers to surrender.
Do you feel safe when you're off on your own? And you know, I should mention here that one of your best friends, Terry Anderson, who was Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press, has been held hostage for 6 years. Bob Simon and his crew from CBS TV are in captivity somewhere. How safe do you feel on your own?
The case of Terry Anderson does not apply here. Terry is a victim of a quite different tragedy in Lebanon. Bob Simon, in fact, as far as I understand, was actually inside Saudi Arabia when he and three of his colleagues were captured by the Iraqis. Certainly, I've been to the place where he was captured, but when I went there, there were Egyptian troops there. I understand that when he was captured, those troops were not there, so the area was more dangerous, and forward Iraqi patrols were there. I don't think there's any doubt that being a journalist in a war zone is dangerous. You only have to ask those correspondents who covered Vietnam. And certainly journalists have been killed in Lebanon as well as kidnapped in that particular war. I think, on the other hand, if you're going to report a war, you have to start on the basis that it will be dangerous, that you have a duty to yourself and to your relatives as well as to your newspaper not to get into trouble if it's possible. But, of course, it is a dangerous place. There's no point in denying it, and if one tried to persuade oneself it was not dangerous, one would end up in trouble.
What do you plan on doing if and when a ground war starts? Where do you?
I'm not going to answer that question because I don't want to give away what my plans are at the time.
Oh, okay.
Let me put it this way: if the authorities want to stop journalists who are not on the pools covering the war, I don't particularly want to talk about my own plans for covering the war. It's as simple as that.
Do you think that you would be stopped if they knew where you were?
I don't know.
There haven't been any attempts to stop you yet, though, right?
On two occasions, I've been stopped at checkpoints and told I can't continue, but I have spoken to the soldiers and persuaded them that it's a good idea that I should continue, and they've permitted me to do so.
These were Saudi or American soldiers?
In one occasion, they were Saudi, and in one occasion, they were Western soldiers.
When you're trying to speak with the military, with troops, or with officers, are you ever afraid that they'll turn on you? and, you know, report you to the censors or something?
Put. No, if they don't want to talk to journalists, they say so. But normally, you know, you have to understand that soldiers are in the desert, they're lonely, they're frightened, they like to see a friendly face. If a Briton or an American sees a British journalist, he's much more likely, as most soldiers do, to ask me what I know is going on. Is it true there's been a peace offer from Iraq? Is it true that the Americans are still bombing Iraq? Than he is to want not to talk. Soldiers need news. Very often we take with us newspapers, which we buy in Tehran or in Riyadh, so that they can see them. They want to read them. And we often exchange our thoughts on the war. In this way, it's very interesting. They have a lot of thoughts which they've worked out on their own out in the desert. And, of course, we have a lot of political views, too. So, in a way, we have very interesting conversations, and they're very keen to hear what news we have and what we've heard on the radio or seen on television. They can't watch television, of course, out there. And as I say, we take along newspapers, both American and British, for them to read.
Well, Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Fisk is Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. He spoke to us from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.